Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, a podcast dedicated to exploring recently published works in the field of Islamic studies. I'm your host, Matt Long, and this week I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Raymond Farron about his book, Structure and Quranic Interpretation. Interest in the structure of the Quran has its beginnings in the 9th century with Muslim scholars. Since that time, Muslim and Western scholars have debated the coherence of the Quran's structure. Raymond Farron, professor of Arabic at the American University of Kuwait, opens his newest book, Structure and Quranic Interpretation, with a historical synopsis of the views adopted by the two primary camps regarding the structure of the Quran and the development of the study of the Quran's constitution. Following in the footsteps of Muslim scholars and Western scholars of Islam, who acknowledged and demonstrated patterns of connectivity between verses and chapters, Farron argues that the entirety of the Quran is organized according to three common patterns of symmetry. As the reader moves from chapter to chapter, Professor Farron explores how these patterns of symmetry are found in individual chapters, chapter pairs, groupings of chapters, systems of chapters, and then the entire corpus. This structural analysis provides Farron the opportunity to explore the overall connectivity of messages throughout the Quran. And accompanying this study, Farron provides multiple appendixes providing structural analysis of selected chapters, a complete listing of the chapter pairs and groupings, a reading group guide of revelations mentioning prophets, and a chronological listing of chapters based on the work of the German scholar Noldecki. Professor Farron's work is a significant contribution to the field. It is of great value to scholars of Islam, but written in terms accessible to all interested in exploring the Quran. Hello, and welcome to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network. Today, we are speaking with Professor Farron about his book, Structure and the Quranic Interpretation. Hello, Professor Farron.
Hello, Matt.
How are you today?
Fine, great. How about you?
I'm doing very well. Your work is wonderful. I've had an opportunity to read it. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a very interesting study of kind of symmetry in the Quran, and I would like to delve into it. But before we do that, if you don't mind, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I graduated from University of Pennsylvania with a BA in English. And at the time, of course, it still is. The university is very expensive in the States. I had gotten an ROTC scholarship to help pay for it. So I had to serve in the Navy a couple years after that. And during my Navy service, I was sent for 1 year seconded to the UN. And I lived in Egypt and Syria. And this is when I started taking Arabic lessons and really started getting fascinated with Arabic. And my original plan was to go back to graduate school and maybe English literature, but I thought at the time, well, maybe I'll do comparative literature. So then I got out of the Navy and I followed what I was really getting interested in. I returned to the region, to Cairo, to the American University in Cairo, where I spent 2 great years of intensive Arabic language study. As a preface to graduate study in Near Eastern studies and comparative literature. And then afterwards I went to Berkeley, where I was in studying in graduate school for 7 years. And I kind of found out then that the more I got into it, the more I was getting fascinated with Arabic literature, that I would retain my love for English literature as just a hobby and really specialize in Arabic. So that's where at Berkeley I got a PhD in Near Eastern studies, with an emphasis in classical Arabic literature, first of all, and then also some modern Arabic literature and also Islam. And I was fortunate enough to get a job right when I was about to graduate. There was a new liberal arts institution opening up in the Gulf here, the American University of Kuwait, and they were advertising for a position in teaching Arabic language and literature. And I applied and I was lucky enough to get it. So here I am at the American University of Kuwait. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm in my 9th year of teaching Arabic and Arabic literature. So that's sort of my academic background.
Okay. And so then academic background, very appropriate in terms of what you had set out to do, I think, in your work. So if you kind of would you go ahead and, let our reader or our listeners know exactly, kind of what
what your aims and goals were with this work, structure and Quranic interpretation.
Sure. Yeah, Berkeley, I specialize in classical Arabic poetry, and rising out of that, my first book, Abundance from the Desert, aims to or challenges a common perception among many Western scholars that Arabic poetry is sort of haphazardly composed. And I pointed to numerous examples of poems composed according to ring composition, where there's a connection between the first idea and the very end, and really the heart of the poem lies in the middle. And, of course, anyone who studies classical Arabic literature has to deal with the fundamental text in Arabic, the Quran. And later, after I finished my first book and I was here in Kuwait, I was surprised to find that also there are numerous people who have criticized the Quran for the same thing, for an apparent or apparent disunity or lack of organization. So I delved into the issue a little more and found that there are numerous scholars lately who've been pointing to examples of symmetry or coherence on the level of the verse or on the level of the individual chapter, the surah as it's called in Arabic, such as Michel Kuipers, a Belgian scholar living in Cairo, and Mustansir Mir in the U.S. So they've really been pointing to symmetrical patterns in parts of the Quran, and I thought as a next challenge, maybe I should look into or look for symmetrical patterns or a symmetrical logic in terms of the Quran as a whole. And so really that's what, I guess to address this, what I think is a misperception on the part of some people that the Quran doesn't have unity or is not really arranged according to a real coherent pattern. And also because I think the structure helps us understand the text. So these are really the main drives that got me into this next project, Structure and Quranic Interpretation.
And as you start to kind of explore some of the history behind, you know, the study of the structure, for those people who might not be familiar with, I don't know if I would call it literary criticism or technique, or I guess maybe even laws of symmetry for that matter, the kind of the three main, I guess you would say maybe patterns that you noticed throughout, and maybe briefly discuss those.
Sure. Yeah. The whole Quran seems to be organized according to the law of symmetry, and it really manifests itself in three main ways in the Quran. The first way according to parallelism, where you'll start with one idea and then go to a second, and then the third one will be sort of a variation on the first, and the fourth will be a variation on the second. I mean, in literary terminology, we say A, B, and then A prime, B prime, sort of. So the second part is really parallel to the first. I mean, there's some new element, but there's also some continuity as well. There's this type of symmetry. Another very common form is chiasm, or a mirror construction, where you start in with one idea and then go to another, and then the third idea is just like the second, and the fourth is just like the first. So the second half of the text is basically thematically or structurally a reverse, inverse of the first half in a mirror image. This is also quite common, but really what seems to be by far most common is a concentric pattern or concentrism. Whereas, I mean, there's a connection between the beginning, the first idea, and the very last. And you notice a similarity between the second idea and the second to last, working your way inward to the core. And really, the core is a unique element. And this is where often the main message is, this has special structurally, this is, has emphasis being in the middle and being unique. And these are the types of symmetry that occur in the Quran. And I really tried to, with this book, to increase the appreciation for the organization of the plan of the Quran, its symmetry. And also, this is coming from literary theory, but structure not only holds the text together, but also can serve as a guide to meaning or to point to certain especially key passages. I mean, of course, with the Quran, a holy text, every verse is holy. But in the way the text is organized, certain passages you can say are central and others are on the ends, peripheral, if you want to use that term. So I thought that perhaps a better structural understanding of the Quran may help us to better understand the text, or at least to highlight certain core or central passages within these concentric structures.
Mm-hmm. Which I think you do very well throughout, really highlighting great examples of these laws at work. And as we start to get into the chapters of your work, you do have the book organized from that sort of the chapter and then into larger groupings of chapter pairings, but we can get into that momentarily. But in the actually in your opening chapter, you don't delve directly into that. You kind of start off just by sort of doing a little framing, and it's particularly around the opening surah of the Quran, correct?
That's correct, yeah. According to concentrism, you have a link between the very beginning and the very end. And I think you find this in terms of the first chapter, the first surah, Al-Fatiha, or the opening, and then the very last, which is people, which the first is a prayer of worship and supplication, affirming that we worship just the one God, and then it's a request for guidance. And then chapters 2 through 112, or the surahs in the middle, are really the answer to prayer, the guidance that is sent down in the Quran. And then, so you start with a prayer, and then you end with two prayers of refuge, seeking refuge in God from Satan. So an example of sort of this framing or correspondence between the two outer ends, and you can even go into greater detail. The very first verse is affirms praise of God, who's the Lord of all peoples. And the peoples intended or meant here are people, all humans and jinn, or humankind and jinn. And all the two rational beings who will be judged on Judgment Day. And then the very last verse of the Quran takes refuge in God from Satan, who whispers into the hearts of al-jinna wa-nas, or humankind and jinn. So you have a connection between the very first verse and the very last, pointing to the two peoples who need the Quran for their salvation. This is just an example of the way the Quran is framed, these two outer chapters.
Mm-hmm. And would you say then that that is kind of an example, again, of the sort of concentrism that you had mentioned before, with the sort of the opening? Yeah. And then the ending like that, and then everything else in the middle kind of almost being that middle special piece.
Exactly. The guidance that these are two prayers on the outer ends, or in the case of Surahs 113 and 114, two prayers of refuge and one prayer at the beginning of worship and supplication. In between them really is the whole the answer to the prayer and the guidance from God, how to live the correctly along and proceed along the straight path. And really also at the very end of Al-Fatiha, the opening, we see that this is there's the guidance here that's offered in the Quran is not something totally new, that the guidance doesn't merely begin with the Quran, but it's a continuation or an elaboration of the existing guidance, the way of the believers throughout the ages. It says, guide us on the straight path, the path of those you favored in the past, not of those who incurred wrath, nor those who went astray. That the Quran offers is essentially a continuation of or elaboration of the existing guidance that had already been passed down to believing peoples throughout the ages. It's not suddenly a clean break with the past. I mean, it's asked for to people to be shown the path of those that God has favored already in the past, not those who've incurred God's wrath or ignored his guidance and gone astray. So this is just a theme that comes up and quite often in the Quran. The Quran is just a confirmation of what has come before. I mean, Islam is not suddenly a totally clean break, but a new religion.
And so then
a continuation of preceding religions. I mean, it's the same one, essentially.
And so that's kind of the very first example that you provide to us. And then as we start moving on in the book, we start then at the level of the individual chapters and your exploration of individual chapters, specifically in in your second chapter, you look at one specific chapter of the Quran to kind of highlight some of these laws of symmetry at work.
That's right. There are basically three main principles. I talk about the chapters of unity or surahs of unity, and then chapter pairs and chapter groups. And the first example I use is the longest chapter or surah in the Quran, the cow, which has 286 verses revealed in Medina. And as I show in the chapter, basically there it consists of seven concentric sections. And in the first part, there's a contrast between the believers who receive this guidance and follow it, and the disbelievers, those who question it, or the hypocrites. And towards the end of the surah, the believers are encouraged for their upcoming conflict with the disbelievers in Mecca in order to regain the Kaaba. So again, sort of a connection between the beginning and the end. And the center, which I see as a center, verses 142 to 52, spell out the new prayer direction for the Muslims, that Mecca is to be their prayer direction. Previously, they had been praying in the direction of Jerusalem along with the Jews. Then the Christians, meanwhile, were praying in the direction of the east towards the rising sun. Suddenly, the prophet receives a revelation that in Medina, of course, Jerusalem is facing north. But suddenly, he receives a revelation that the direction should change due south, pretty much, towards Mecca. And do you continue praying, bowing down towards Jerusalem, or follow him and pray towards Mecca? Well, this is a test of faith. And then it really is put in a larger perspective right here in the center of the chapter. It says that every community has its own direction, own prayer direction. I mean, the Christians in one direction, Jews in another, now the Muslims in a new direction. So the answer is to compete with each other in doing good works and try to outdo each other in terms of virtue and merit. And God will reward you all on Judgment Day. So repeatedly in central passages, it seems like pluralism is emphasized, or to put aside doctrinal disputes and really focus on the larger issue, or the main point, to believe in the one God and live a life of good works. And if you're going to differ about things like prayer orientation or other doctrinal points, I mean, those are really not so important. What should, if you're going to differ, well, or you should try to compete with each other and see who can be the do the most good works, who can help the poor the most and most just and so forth.
And one thing that I took note of as looking at that chapter is that as you go through the exploration of, so it's the second chapter of the Quran, so Surah Baqarah, that in your chapter, you highlight the main sections and show the concentric pattern of those sections based on how many verses for each one of those. I believe it's A, B, C, D, and then you said A. What was the literary term for it?
I think this is concentrism.
So, but then what's great about your book, though, is that at the you have an appendix at the end that then actually goes into the actual verses and sections in a much more detailed look. So we can kind of see the overall pattern just in the chapter, but then we can then actually break down verses when we look at your appendix. And I thought that was a very great addition.
Oh, glad
to what
I'm very
you've done.
Glad to hear you say that. This is actually advice of my friend and colleague, Simon O'Meara, who had advised that I try to write to, as much as possible, write to a lay reader and put all the details, all the proof in the appendices. I mean, if someone is interested, they can go read them there. But I mean, I think it could be very laborious if all these details and were in the opening chapter or in the front part of the book. So,
but I also, upon reading that, I also kind of noticed, so when we look at the actual chapter, there's the concentrism occurring with various verses, but then even within one of those sections, there's almost sort of the same sort of symmetry at work within one of those individual units as well.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Yeah, it seems to go on very small patterns to larger ones. I mean, rings within rings And indeed, even in the level of one verse, the throne verse, the 255th verse of Surah Al-Baqarah, as Mahdi as Azaiz has shown, is also arranged according to a concentric pattern, with the idea of God's knowledge being unlimited, extending into eternity in the very center. So you have this small ring, and that's in turn part of a section that's also concentrically arranged, which is in turn part of a surah, 286 verses that also seem to have the same concentric patterning, and really just an extension of what these other researchers have pointed out, like Michelle Kuipers and Mustansir Mir. I mean, not only on the level of the individual verses, but I think it extends on the level of groups and groups of surahs, and the whole Quran as a whole is arranged according to the same logic.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you move on to then in your third and fourth chapters, is kind of talking about how then that chapters are then sort of paired with other chapters as well.
Yeah. Out of the 114 surahs in the Quran, most of them tend to occur in pairs. I mean, this is a phenomenon of two independent wholes located adjacent to each other, but together they form a new composite unit that thematically and structurally they're related and complement each other. And the example I give in that chapter, the first one, because I just discussed Surah Al-Baqarah in the previous chapter, then we see how the pairing between the family of Imran, which is another Medinan surah revealed around the same time period, how structurally and thematically it complements Al-Baqarah. I mean, it also consists of seven sections in a concentric pattern, and each section seems to correspond with the identical section in the previous surah. So, for example, the family of Imran also begins with the three letters Alif, Lam, Mim, just like Al-Baqarah does. It also ends with a prayer, just like Al-Baqarah ends with a prayer for help against the disbelievers. They're about to fight them. They're going to try to liberate the Kaaba and reclaim Mecca from the disbelievers. This is how Al-Baqarah ends. Well, Al-Imran, or the family of Imran, ends with a prayer for salvation. So either a prayer for help against the disbelievers or a prayer for salvation. And also, I thought in the middle, you see emphasis on a larger message, really calling on the Muslims or the believers to be unified in the face of conflict, both abroad against the Meccan polytheists and in Medina, where the resident the Jews and maybe some itinerant Christians were debating them and trying to pull the Muslims to their side. And so in addition to this call for unity in the center, you also have a call for the emergence of a model community, one of believers that promotes good and deters evil. So again, similar to the center of Al-Baqarah, where it says compete with each other in doing good works. Well, here in the center of Al-Imran, the family of Imran says that, you know, the Muslims, the believers should be a community that promotes good in society and prevents or deters evil. And I mean, these are ways that they're structurally similar. They're also, in other ways, complementary. They both deal with the clash or the armed conflict with the polytheists in Mecca. But whereas Al-Baqarah, the first one, Surah 2, prepares the Muslims for an upcoming expected clash or battle, the next one, Surah 3, looks back on the first two major engagements at Badr and Uhud, and sort of deals with the lessons learned from those two engagements. So they both have that theme in common, and also they both deal with the doctrinal disputes that were going on at the time in Medina with the people of the book, the Jewish community, and the Christians who were passing through. And whereas the Surah 2 deals mostly with the arguments put forward by the Jews, Surah 3 then focuses on the differences with the Christians. But together they kind of deal with this, the conflict, doctrinal conflict with the people of the book, and also the military conflict with the polytheists. So I think that it's an example of two independent, coherent surahs that together complement each other and form a new unit or a pair.
And again, even though there's so many examples that could be used and you're only able to focus on so much in your work, but you still provide the readers with the full pairings in one of your appendixes as well, which I think is a great addition.
Oh, thank you.
And then after kind of looking at the pairs, then you move on to an even larger section. And in your fifth chapter, when you talk about chapter groupings, you not only talk about groupings, but I think then you add a layer that might not have been ever explored before as well.
Yeah. If I can quickly just go back to one other pair that came to mind, then go on to the grouping. There are two other Medinan Meccan surahs, Joseph and Thunder, numbers 12 and 13. They were also both revealed around the same time that seemed to be function as a pair that I, the first one in the example of Joseph, an example of God's intervention in human affairs, and how he rescues Joseph from his brothers who were envying him. And because he's the favored son, and they throw him in the well, basically leave him to die or for caravanners to pick him up. And he's picked up and taken to Egypt, and then he goes on and prospers there in Egypt. And once he becomes the advisor to the king, and there's a famine in Canaan or where his brothers live, they come to him, and gradually he's able to bring them all back or bring the family together again in Egypt. And this is a sign of God's intervention, how he can bring about family reunions sometimes in this world, in this chapter, extraordinarily. And I think it's complemented with thunder, where it shows God's amazing signs in nature, lightning and thunder and other matters, other phenomena like that. But together, I think these are addressed to the polytheists in Medina and Mecca at the time, around 619, 620, right before the emigration to Medina, who were basically incredulous, disbelieving the Prophet Muhammad about God. And these are two examples of how God is alive and all-powerful and sometimes can intervene in human affairs, and his signs are very present in nature. And actually, one commentator, Sayyid Qutb, pointed out, I thought it was a very interesting observation, that Joseph may have inspired the emigration to Medina, because the situations are very parallel. I mean, the Prophet at the time in Mecca was among his kin, and they were incredulous and starting to persecute him. And maybe that this surah inspired him and the community around him with the idea, well, that maybe Islam, even though they're facing persecution and disbelief among their own kin there in Mecca, well, maybe abroad in Medina it might take root and thrive. And even though the brothers in the Joseph story hate him so much that they want to kill him, eventually when Joseph becomes established in Egypt and he treats them very well, he fills up their saddlebags, and they come back, and he forgives them and says God will forgive them, and the family is reunited in Egypt. Maybe this was sort of inspiring them that perhaps this is just a temporary phenomenon, all this hatred that the Muslims were facing in Mecca, that maybe down the road the family or the kin could be reunited on happy terms. Anyway, this is another example, and I think there are very many, and then I pointed in the appendix to all the different surah pairs. In fact, it seems like most of the adjacent surahs are form pairs. Mm-hmm. And I guess that one digression, but then you asked, I think, about the chapter groups, the surah groups?
Yes, not only the groupings, but then in that same section, you also kind of move to a level that I don't know if anyone else has explored, where you kind of look at systems as well.
Yeah, this is really the grouping is, I think, is a third main principle. I mean, first that every surah is a unity, is a coherent whole, and then the idea that they're paired, that these two wholes come together in a relationship of complementarity. And then the last one is that more surahs are grouped together, between 3 and 10. Usually the average is about 6, according to the same principles, according to parallelism or concentrism in terms of theme and structure. You may have a theme introduced in the first pair and then the last pair in the group that you come back to that theme. Basically, that's the principle. I treat a couple of groups and then trying to build on what other, and these have been in most cases recognized by previous scholars. And for example, 2 to 5, these four surahs that contain lots of legislation, they were all revealed in Medina in the latter part of the Prophet's mission. They deal with the struggle to regain or to take, to conquer Mecca after the Muslims were expelled. I mean, there you see a lot of similarities that they hold together as a coherent group. Many scholars have pointed to the existence of these various groups. And I guess I was just trying to add to it, maybe add one more further block that to the structure or to the plan of the analysis, but basically saying that these groups are also arranged according to what seems to be a concentric pattern, or in terms of you have 9 groups in the first half of the Quran, and these are surahs 2 through 49, centered on the pilgrimage to Mecca. And in fact, in the third surah, you have a reference to the old name for Mecca, which is Bekka. This is the only time it occurs in the Quran. And then in surah 48 at the very end, another reference to Mecca. So the two outer ends reference to Mecca. And in the center of this system, or these 9 groups put together, a reference to the pilgrimage. And so I think you have 9 groups in the first part, half of the Quran, then a central group of 7 surahs, 50 to 56, and then on the other end, another 9 groups that are also arranged apparently concentrically. Within 57, a reference to the conquest of Mecca, and then in surah 90, which is called the city, or which is pretty clear, it's reference to Mecca, and then coming at the end again, the conquest of Mecca at 110. So basically trying to outline what seems to be the overall concentric plan of the Quran and the disposition and the arrangement of these groups.
And that really, that system is, as you said, the entirety of the whole work, the whole entire Quran. And then, you know, by elaborating and viewing the system, you kind of look at one specific then section. I guess you would call it another sort of grouping of chapters 50 through 56. And then this is then becomes the theme of your final chapter, the central group.
Right. Again, it's the same principle at work. You have 19 groups, and the middle one, the 10th one, is 50 to 56. These are all middle-length Meccan surahs, and they all are tied together dealing with one main theme, that is the hereafter. And as I show in that chapter, I think they're also arranged, these 7, according to a concentric pattern, especially with references to the Quran at the very beginning and then also at the very end, 50 and then 56. But really, the center, this middle group of the Quran, seems to be itself centered on 2 particular surahs, number 54, the moon, and number 55. The former emphasizing God's awesomeness and his punishment of past peoples who disobeyed, the peoples of Noah, of Ad, of Thamud, people of Lot, and Pharaoh, all of them disobeyed, ignored the guidance that was being provided to him. A prophet was coming to him and telling him, believe in God, live a life of good works, and they chose to continue in sin, and they were destroyed. One of them, Thamud, in an instant by a massive quake or shock. And so basically this first of the 2 central surahs, the moon, 54, emphasizes God's majesty, his awesomeness, and his fearsomeness for those who disobey him. While the complementary surah number 55, the merciful emphasizes his mercy, and with how he bestows so much bounty on humans and jinn here in this life, filling the seas with fish and the fruits on the earth, and basically providing so much and so mercifully providing all this sustenance for us on earth, and even more in the afterlife, the paradise that's promised for the believers, those who believe and do good. So what I think here, you really have the central part of the Quran focused on the afterlife and giving a portrait through metaphorical language, of course, but the portrait of the two essential aspects or attributes of God, his almighty nature, how he will punish those who deviate, who ignore his warnings and continue in sin, and on the other side, his mercy.
And you actually, you state that this section might actually be connected to a very specific verse from the Quran as well.
Often with concentrism, there's a link between the very beginning and the very end, and then the middle part is also tied to the two outer ends to sort of tie the whole together as a unit. And here, in the three parts of the Quran, the very malikiness, or the maliki yawmiddin, basically master of the day of judgment. This occurs in al-Fatiha, the first surah. And then in the middle, malik, which is an intensive form of a sovereign, malik muqtadir. And then at the very end of the Quran, you have malikiness, the king of people. People being humankind and jinn. So I get my point. What I was trying to say is basically in the three parts of the Quran, the very beginning, the very middle, and the very end, you have the three terms for Arabic terms for king or sovereign used, Malik, Malik, and Malik. And the middle term is only used one time in the Quran. Malik, an omnipotent sovereign, is used there right in the middle. Also, I guess another interesting point, the Quran, first verse, refers to the two rational peoples, humankind and jinn. And then, as I said, the last verse of the Quran is a prayer for take refuge from Satan, who whispers in the hearts, breasts of humankind and jinn. And in the middle, in Surah 55, this is the one surah that's addressed directly rhetorically to humankind and jinn, and keeps saying the question, which bounties of God do you deny, listing all how he's merciful in this life and the next life. So ways that I think the beginning, middle, and end of the Quran are all tied very tightly, coherently together.
Great. Thank you very much. And so then in conclusion, in the conclusion of your work, you know, I think that you've done a lot to really demonstrate the laws of symmetry at work, especially, you know, the concentrism on the all different levels that are occurring. Is there anything else that, you know, that you would like to add to that?
Well, in the conclusion, it seems like the consistency of the structure on the level of the individual verse, oftentimes on the level of the surah, the symmetry is found, and the pair and the group and the system and the Quran as a whole points to a logical conclusion in my mind that a single author, I mean, it's hard to imagine a committee coming up with something that's all so tightly tied together. I mean, it's consistent across all levels. And basically, I guess the goals of the book that I just tried to hopefully encourage a greater appreciation for the amazing organization of the Quran. And also, I think if we pay, you know, increasingly attention to the structure it also can serve to, as I said, highlight certain central meanings. And again, it seems to be the ethical meanings are in the center, to take care of the poor, to take care of the downtrodden, the widows, the orphans, of course, to believe in God. But it seems again and again, this is what the Quran structurally is emphasizing. And of course, there are other aspects. I mean, there's so many other points that it makes, and it lays down a whole body of law and so forth and so on. But again, it seems to be the central message are the ethical messages.
And it seems that also when you're making the case for single authorship, that you also include empirical evidence that seems to suggest that, some ideas of the compilation occurring later are not necessarily the case.
Right. There's been radiocarbon dating of a manuscript that was found in Yemen, in Sana'a, it was analyzed at Stanford a couple of years ago. And basically, they found like a 70% or 80%, I believe, probability that this particular manuscript was copied within 18 years of the Prophet's death in 632. So it seems like science is also pointing. I mean, there was a theory going around that maybe the Quran was put together much later, during the Umayyad period, for example, 685 or 700, or perhaps even later. But I think literary evidence points that there's one author who put it together. Whether or not he was divinely inspired, of course, that's a question of faith. But it seems to be the consistency of this method makes it much more likely that it was one author who compiled it, and it wasn't compiled by a committee. And the science seems to be pointing to the same probability.
Excellent. Well, Professor Farron, thank you so much for your time, discussing your book. I was hoping that you might take another minute. Do you have any upcoming projects that you plan on working on? I do know that this book was wonderful, and it could probably be expanded. Anything like that in the future?
Yes. Well, this forthcoming project is working on an article analyzing the structure of Surah 4 that has a connection. It also seems to be concentrically organized with a beginning emphasizing justice and a beginning talking about inheritance issues and justice and dealing with orphans and wives. And it comes back to that point at the very end. And in the middle, there you find an example of the Prophet putting the principle of justice in practice. There's a reference to an incident where at the time in Medina, a Muslim, one of the Prophet's supporters, stole some armor from a Jew. And then he was later suspected of the crime and tried planting it, or he stole some armor and then he planted it in a Jew's house, actually, and tried to frame this Jew residing in Medina. And other Muslims came to his side, but it turns out that the evidence was clear. And the Prophet, in this case, ruled against the Muslim. Even if this is a time when there were lots of disputes and problems with the Jewish community in Medina. But, I mean, this is an example of not just preaching about justice, but about putting it into practice. I mean, even when this means going against one's own core constituency, ruling for the Jew against his fellow Muslims. Anyway, I think the power of this example is central in the surah. I'd like to develop that and hopefully turn it into an article.
Wonderful. Anything else, or is that just going to be your main focus for right now?
Maybe eventually I'll get back to poetry, but I guess I'm really hooked on analyzing different parts of the Quran, and I think I might continue for a while doing detailed analysis. I mean, there are 114 surahs, so I think I may be busy for a while trying to do a structural analysis of many, detailed structural analysis of many, especially the longer ones.
That will definitely keep your hands full, and we look forward to reading more about it as well.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you about this fascinating subject.
This has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, and you have a good day, okay?
Thanks. You too.
Thank you for joining as I spoke with Professor Raymond Farron about his book, Structure and Quranic Interpretation. Please be sure to stop in again to the Islamic Studies section of the New Books Network for another new interview in the upcoming weeks. Also, be sure to check out one of our other channels on the New Books Network. Thank you very much for joining us.